G'day, everybody. My name's Glenn Hill.
Jacob Meyer.
And welcome to another Tactical Tennis Podcast. And today we get to talk about the aftermath of the US Open.
Rafa did some damage.
He did. He once again closed the gap on Fed, picking up number 16. It feels like it's 2008 again. But anyways, so let's break down a little bit the semis first, and then we can jump in and talk about the finals. And then there's been some pretty exciting Davis Cup play happening, even though Australia lost.
Yeah, sorry about that, big guy.
Yeah, me too.
Actually, I am sorry about that.
Yeah. Well, anyways, okay, back to the US Open. Happy your thoughts here for a moment.
Well, unless you're Del Potro.
Well.
But let's start there. I mean, Rafa got through Del Potro, which I think didn't surprise a lot of people. We both picked that, obviously.
Well, I think it surprised some people. You know, Del Potro's one of these guys that people are really big on him. And look, I love the contact that he makes on his forehand as much as the next person. But it seems as though he is one of these characters in the tennis world whom fans really gravitate towards. And I think that his injury history has really made his career something of an enigma. I see a lot of what-ifs, you know, or not even what-ifs. I see a lot of people basically just say flat out that if Del Potro hadn't gotten injured, he would be one of the, you know, great players, and he'd be, you know, 5-6 slams deep at this point.
Do you buy that?
I don't, personally, no.
No, I don't buy that at all, and I can tell you very clearly why, but what makes you say that you don't buy that Del Potro would be one of the all-time greats if he didn't have so many injuries?
Because he's your classic, very good, but your classic, you know, very tall, very aggressive player. You know, he's relatively consistent for a bigger guy, but he's still a bit streaky. There isn't really a great plan B for him. He's either hitting his forehand well and hopefully serving well, or he isn't. And when he isn't, there's not a lot for him to fall back on. And that's really the thing that differentiates, you know, the quote-unquote big four from everybody else is, you know, the fact that they can win when they're not playing well. They can beat almost everybody else on tour even when they're not playing well. And that's not true for Del Potro. And you just can't play well all the time.
That's an interesting way to think about it, because I think of Del Potro almost as being like a tall Andre Agassi, in the sense that he's just trying to hit lasers on everything, like flat serve, flat forehand, flat backhand. He's trying to hit through you. The big difference that I see between him and the guys that have come to dominate the sport, whether you go back to Agassi or back to Sampras, or whether you look at Rafa and Fed and Murray and Djokovic, is Del Potro doesn't have that kind of work ethic. I mean, here's a guy who injured his wrist and came back to the game out of shape. Whereas, you know, Fed takes 6 months off and doesn't lose a match for months. You know, like, he obviously put work in. And, I mean, Del Potro's just, he's just not going to put the hours in.
That's interesting.
Don't see him traveling with a coach. Like, he could have come back to the game having the time off that he had. An absolute student of strategy, of tactics, of the other players, of, I don't know, anything. Like, I almost don't even care. Like, he could have picked 20 different things to focus his energy on and just become one of the best people at that. And he would have come back a better player. And instead, he's come back not as good as when he left. And some things I think are actually better. I think his forehands continue to improve. I think his serve has continued to improve.
Sure.
But that doesn't make up for the damage that was done to his backhand stroke in a technical aspect because of wrist surgeries and the confidence that he has there.
Right.
But beyond that, I mean, the real difference to me is just off court, the way that he approaches the game. I can't imagine, you know, in fact, later on, we're going to look more closely at Kevin Anderson and his final against Rafa. Kevin was a guy who played number six on his college team. Like, when he got to University of Illinois, he was the number six player. Okay. I don't think that Kevin has as great of a game as Del Potro does. I don't know that I like Kevin as much as I like Juan Martín. I don't know. I mean, they're both really nice guys. It's hard to tell. But I have a tremendous amount of respect for Kevin because he's building his game. Like, he's earning it.
He keeps getting better. Just keeps getting better.
Into the top 10.
And he's had his share of injuries as well.
Absolutely. And but every time he comes back better and better. And he took a really bad loss in Melbourne last year to Rajiv Ram in the first or second round. And it exposed some real confidence issues that he had on his forehand. You know what he did? He went and he worked on it for a year and a half. Like, you can't ask a lot more than that from a guy, but there's a lot that I could still ask from Delpo. I mean, I love his game. I think the potential is tremendous. I think he absolutely has the potential to hit everybody on the tour off the court. And maybe one day we will see a guy his size with his tools and all the off-court dedication that Rafa has. But Juan Martín's not that guy.
Right. Yeah, you know, and the thing to me is I don't personally think that even if he did that work that he would be, you know, a 5-6-time slam winner in this era. I mean, I think he perfectly fits the mold of the pre-Big Four era where you had players who had a lot more holes in their game. They had their strengths, they had their weaknesses. And that he's very much more in that vein to me than the current era where I just think you have to be good at so many things. And especially at defense to really have the week in week out results, and so having said that, you know, I mean, I think to both of us, we both thought that Rafa was going to win that match, and you know, he did it pretty comfortably. I mean, for all that Delpo won a set, that wasn't really a particularly competitive match.
Yeah, it never felt like Delpo was going to actually win.
No, even at the end of the first, and the other match I think was an interesting one, and that's where we had Karina Busta and Kevin Anderson. And KA got through it in 4 sets.
Yeah, so I mean, the first thing we have to say, the first thing that I have to say, is that I picked Karina Busta based on the matchup there and against what I felt like was not just going with the hot player, but it just felt like Kevin was playing well. It felt like, hey, you know, there's a good chance he's going to show up here and he's going to play really well. And I didn't really know what to expect emotionally from Karina Busta. But if you recall, the reason I picked Karina Busta to get to that match was because I thought it would be very hard to establish serve plus one and really dominate your own service games against him. He seems to make that very difficult on people.
Right, but guess what Kevin Anderson did a great job of?
Lo and behold, how did Kevin Anderson do on serve?
Absolutely dominated. I mean, Karina Busta won 22% of receiving points across the entire match. Kevin Anderson stepped up to the plate, banged down 22 aces in 4 sets, 1 double fault, made 69% first serves.
Tough.
That's how he did.
Yeah. So, and it's not just the aces. Like, honestly, I think Karina Busta can withstand the aces. But one thing that we'll see, you know, when we look at the, you know, another opponent that Kevin played in Rafa in the final, is that he was much harder to ace. You know, so I don't mind Karina Busta getting aced 20 times in 4 sets, but I was just dead wrong. I mean, Kevin was able to serve plus one all day against him.
Right. So yeah, it's not the aces; it's the other points you have to be able to win. And Karina Busta didn't do a stellar job there. You know, and the final, you know, because I thought Kevin was going to get through that semi, but, you know, the final was something of a letdown at the end of the day. It was not a competitive match. And, you know, I certainly had hoped it would be. And I've said this before. I'm not sure if I said this before in the previous podcast, but I know that I certainly made a comment to this effect on Reddit that, look, I mean, being his first Grand Slam final, there's always going to be a chance that he would kind of show up but not really show up, you know, and bring a very subpar performance. But I thought that if he did show up, that was actually going to be a very competitive match because of how well Anderson had been serving throughout the entire tournament. And unfortunately, KA didn't really actually show up very well. He served quite poorly.
So this is where I'm not sure. Like, I feel like Kevin showed up fairly well. Like, I still remember the Kanish Okoye, Marin Cilic US Open final from a few years ago, where Kay was a shadow of himself. Like, he lost a ton of velocity on every ball. He wasn't hitting out. It wasn't just that he wasn't playing great. I mean, he was obviously overwhelmed by the moment. I mean, Kevin, it felt like, maybe got tight in some big moments, on some break points. In times that really ended up playing a huge role in the match. But overall, it seemed like he played his game. I mean, he plays matches like this a lot.
But not, like, I mean, he hadn't, this was his worst serving performance of the entire tournament. And I'm not talking from a, hey, he didn't serve as many aces standpoint. I'm talking about his first serve percentage, his second serve percentage, his double faults. I mean, his
59% per thirds.
Yeah, that's 10% down from his semifinal.
The question is, what made him do that? Was it just nerves because he was in the final, or was it because, I mean, Rafa had a very particular strategy about dealing with his serve?
Oh, absolutely. But I, you know, again, I don't think that I think he served poorly, whether it's a result of nerves or whatever you want to call it. I don't think that the low first serve percentage was a response to any strategy on Rafa's part. I think that's a bad serving day. And, you know, we'll never really know why he had a bad serving day, but I think he came out and just functionally did not serve well that day.
See, I disagree with you on that. I think Rafa puts a ton of pressure on you, just making every return, being in every point, hitting huge forehands, running everything down. And I think that directly affected him. I think if you put somebody else out there, like I think if you had put Cilic on the other side of the net in that final, still being his first final, I think Kevin would have served the same way he did against Kronj Busta. I think he showed us that by doing it all tournament.
Yeah, I see, but every other match in the tournament wasn't the final. And I think it's...
Sure, but you can say that for every round. Like, we could have said that about, like... I mean,
well, but come on. I mean, we can't... You can say that for every round, of course, but you can't act like the quarterfinals is going to be the same emotional impact for... The same is going to have the same level of emotional impact as the final will. You can't say the nerves are going to be the same. I mean, they're just not...
No, I'm not saying that it would be the same. I'm just saying that I would have expected to see more breakdowns from Kevin in the semis and in the quarters. And you got to remember, like, he hadn't made it even close to this far. So every step was like a huge emotional journey for him. And he seemed to be pretty well prepared for it. I really feel like a lot of people can back up really far, and the way that Kevin serves, they're going to put a lot of pressure on him. Like, he's going to drop his serving percentage if you can get your teeth into his service
game. I'm going to say one thing to that I think just... In the second set, Kevin Anderson made 36% first serves. I'm sorry, but I just don't think Rafa standing back 10 feet is going to make him miss... What, 14 out of 22 first serve attempts?
Okay. Well,
he's a professional tennis player. I just think he had a bad day.
Let's talk about... I mean, he shouldn't have bad days. He's 6'8". He shouldn't ever have a time where he can't serve 50% first serves.
To me, exactly.
That has to speak directly to what is he trying to do.
No, to me that speaks directly to the occasion.
Well, so let's talk about what Rafa did and what made it effective.
Sure. I mean, Rafa went and stood basically back by the backboards. I mean, he's standing a few feet by the line judge.
Which is how far?
I mean, he's a good 12 feet behind the baseline, I want to say.
Even more.
Yeah, 12, 15. I mean, it's a little... He's far enough back that it's hard to say. I mean, you're pulling out binoculars to see the baseline from where he's standing.
He might be 20 feet back. I mean, he's a long way back. I should actually get that Hawkeye data. But he's really, really, really far back. I mean, one of our friends was tweeting about, you know, all these pictures where you can't even see Rafa in the shot.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he's as far back as I've ever seen anybody stand on a tennis court, ever. Let's just put it like that. I mean, he's at the place where people go to retrieve overheads when they're, you know, in really bad shape in a point. And that's where he returns serve from consistently throughout the match.
So what effect does that have on Kevin?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, look, I don't think that realistically has any effect on Kevin. I think that Kevin's not an idiot. Kevin's a professional tennis player. Kevin knows he's not going to serve through Rafa when Rafa's standing that far back. So I don't think Kevin steps up and tries to do anything particularly harder or bigger or better than he has been doing. I just think the occasion got to him, and the effect is that he, regardless of where Rafa's standing, has a bad serving day. Everybody has those. Wow. You know, the problem for Kevin is that whereas taking the bad serving day out of it, the problem for Kevin is that more serves that he does make are going to come back. Because one thing Kevin doesn't do a good job of is spreading the box, especially for a guy of his height. I mean, what's going to happen to Rafa if he stands that far back on the deuce court against Fed?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, I'm asking. What was the question?
I mean, if Rafa stands too far back against Federer or against, I don't know, a guy that I coach, then he's going to get served wide the whole time.
Yeah, he's going to get wrecked on the wide serve. But he gets away with that from Anderson because Anderson doesn't really spread the pucks very well. Which
wide serve isn't really wide.
Yeah, for a 6'8" guy, that's not great. I mean, he relies a lot more on the pace. And look, he's a fairly accurate server, but he doesn't really have as wide a range in the box as, you know, some players. I mean, like, Fed's wide serve goes ridiculously more wide than Anderson's does. Anderson's really firing a laser beam to the corner, whereas Fed's shaping that serve and curving it up high in the box. And so the problem is...
serve on the deuce side goes farther than Kevin's on the deuce side. Yeah. And just let it sink in. I mean, Rafa's 6 inches shorter than Kevin is.
Yeah. So that should happen. So the thing is, a lot of when Kevin makes his first serve and makes his second serve, a lot more of those are going to come back and play than he's used to. And then he's in a lot more points.
Well,
whereas used to a lot more serves not coming back.
It seems like you're laying out a situation that does affect a guy mentally. I mean, Kevin is... I'm going to say, actually, that Kevin's a consummate professional. Like, he works very, very hard. He's very organized. He's very disciplined. He's one of the harder working guys on tour. He's missed time away with injury. He comes back better. He's taken bad losses. He goes. He learns. He comes back better. I mean, you don't have to love Kevin Anderson's game, but you have to respect the way that he goes about his business.
Sure.
But still, to me, or not just to me, I think to every guy on tour, when you start putting them in situations that they're not used to, right, either you're going to say they're easy for them to handle and it's no big deal at all, or it starts to get into a psychological aspect of the game where maybe they start to press or they start to get into patterns that they're not familiar with. And when we get into those patterns, what do? We press in a different way, right? Or we start to make decisions that maybe aren't so good. We don't know how to work ourselves into the patterns that we actually do like. So, I mean, Kevin found himself playing a lot of points here that really, he was just neutral in a baseline rally from the middle of the court with Rafa, which is not a winning position.
Right. Well, the thing is, he wasn't really neutral in a lot of them. That's the thing is, he you know, he's getting a lot of points where he is still ahead. But he didn't do a great job of, you know, this is the thing to me, is it was just he was sloppy. Like, he was sloppy in a way we hadn't really seen throughout the tournament. You know, he missed a lot of his plus one balls, or if not the plus one, the one after that. And some of the credit for that has to go to Rafa, absolutely. You know, I mean, when Rafa's going to hunt down the ball that struck as well as some of the balls that Anderson struck and come back with the depth that it did, that's certainly something that Anderson, I think, isn't used to seeing and doesn't get the opportunity to see very often. And certainly, I think that made him press off the ground a little bit. I think he certainly felt the pressure to press off the ground.
And, definitely, yeah.
And that was obvious to me.
This is what would strike me is, you know, what would Kevin Anderson's constitution have to be where he would feel the pressure to press off the ground, but he wouldn't feel it on his serve? Neither one of us think that he's a great server.
I think he's a very, very good server. And the thing is, look, it's not... there's nowhere to press. Again, 36% first serves in a set, like for an entire set from a 6'8" guy. Like, there's just... that's the worst serving you had the entire tournament. And I just think that the nerves, the situation, play such a huge role in that. Because here's the thing that's telling to me is, the third set, after his first service game, Kevin Anderson served like an absolute champ when he was down two sets in a break. Rafa's still standing in the same place, and Anderson finally, like, gets it together.
See, I don't know about
75% that. 75% first serves in the third set, but all that came after the break.
I think that he's just going for it at that point. I mean, I've seen guys when they're down, you know, breaking that final set, serve 100% first serves for the rest of the match.
Right, but
they're not doing it in a sustainable way. Okay.
Well, these are the kind of numbers that Ed Anderson was doing throughout the whole tournament. He just finally did it when the match was out of his hands.
I mean, this reminds me a lot of, like, and you may think I'm absolutely crazy and I don't know what I'm talking about for this, but it reminds me a lot of Ivo Karlovic. Okay, or like a doubles guy with a huge serve, where if you can sneak a couple of good returns off of a good first serve, it really changes how they go about things. I mean, if you look back at Ivo, you can see Karlovic playing tournaments where he's cruising along 70% in a match, 70%, 70% for a couple of rounds, and then somebody seemingly makes a few good returns and he drops to 50, which doesn't make any sense. Unless it's a psychological thing, unless it's an approach thing, unless he's giving too much credit.
Well, but there's other factors. I mean, look, people don't, we're not robots. People don't show up and play exactly the same every day.
That's true.
You know, I mean, especially when you start adding in the different stages of the tournament and the psychological impact that has. My point just is this. I just think off the return of serve, I mean, when we look at Anderson's first serve percentage and the number of double faults that he threw in, I mean, look, I'll give Rafa some of the credit for some of the doubles. Absolutely. Because nice. I think that Anderson felt pressure to not start the point behind on his second serve, and he pressed more.
Right.
You know? But I'm just saying, like, as badly as Anderson hit his first serve most of that match, that's a bad serving day for him. And I'm not super keen to give all the credit to Rafa. I don't think Rafa deserves a ton of the credit for that. I think Rafa did a great job of adopting the right strategy. And I think Anderson was overwhelmed by the occasion and did not come out and play well.
So you made that very clear. We're going to wrap this part up by saying, I'm just going to say that I've come off of this from a different perspective, right? I think that it was exactly those adjustments that Rafa made. And Kevin's response to not being able to win easy free points and to not being able to get easy returns on those some of those first serves that he bangs to the corners, I think that really got to him. I think he needs those points. I think that that's the way.
Oh, I agree. I agree he needs the points. But the thing is, like, when he was making the serve, he was getting a lot of them still.
Some, yeah. I think just not enough. And I think that this is the tiny, tiny differences that these tennis matches change on. To me, this is one of them. I don't actually think it was the occasion, which I find a little bit strange because I actually expected Kevin to really falter in the occasion. I think he's been very volatile emotionally and psychologically as a player over the whole course of his career, going all the way back into junior, going before college, going all the way back into junior times. So, I mean, I had my own expectations that I didn't make public about that. He really impressed me. He held things together very well. I think where he really had trouble was with the patterns and the way that he had to play points and the way that he had to win here. I don't think he knows how to beat a player doing what Rafa did.
Wait. So let me get this straight. You expected him to falter because of the occasion, and he gets up there on the big stage and falters, and now you're telling me you don't think it was because of the occasion.
Yeah,
and that's exactly what you expected.
What I'm saying is I actually don't think he faltered. What I think is that Rafa broke him down, and I don't think those
But
are
then
the
why
same.
Did he play? I mean, like, if Rafa broke him down, why did he play his best tennis in the third set?
Because I think he thought it was hopeless and he's just going for it.
But that's the thing. Like, he didn't come out in the third set. Like, this is why I just have a trouble with this is in the first set, he doesn't come out trying to do anything different in his serve than we've seen him do all tournament. We didn't see him try and spread the box more. We didn't see him go bigger. He came out and just served business as usual. Second set, he comes out and tries to serve business as usual. Third set, he comes out and serves business as usual. The difference is he didn't serve well.
I just don't see it that way. I do see him trying to do different things. I saw him going bigger. I mean, I saw him trying to go bigger. And
okay. I mean, I guess we'll have to disagree on that one because I didn't see any numbers in the speed gun that suggested that to me. But anyways, we can talk a little bit about Davis Cup.
Yeah, so
there's some fantastic stuff happening there. There's some really good tennis over the last few days.
Some really interesting stuff going on, especially in the Australia and Belgium tie.
Yes.
We were talking about it off the air earlier. And
so I guess let's set the stage about, you know, how that tie went, how it opened at least. And then maybe when we talk about the ending of it, it'll all make a little more sense. So we've got Belgium's playing Australia in Belgium. And it's on the red clay, indoors, which is an interesting combination.
Yes.
And so we open with Goffin takes down John Millman in four sets, right? And Kyrgios took down Darcis in five.
Which, can we talk, I mean, like, at some point we have to talk about, Steve Darcis has been unbelievable in Davis Cup for Belgium.
Yes.
Unbelievable. Like, he plays like a top 20 player, hands down, when he plays Davis Cup.
When he plays Davis Cup, yeah.
Like, he's ranked 77.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I mean, he's been ranked higher than that, but he's never been a top 40 guy, as far as I know, or he certainly hasn't been there for long. I mean, he's usually somewhere between 50 and 100.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Davis Cup, once he puts on the shirt for Belgium, he becomes a monster.
I mean, unbelievable.
So, that brings us to the doubles rubber, and this is where we see John Peers and Jordan Thompson come out and steamroll the Belgian team, 3-4-0.
Yeah, which is an absolute smacking in Davis Cup doubles.
Yeah, And so that sets the stage for what we think should be, you know, I mean, Australia's up 2-1 at this point. Kyrgios is there. He's motivated. He's playing quite well. I mean, the last two sets against Darcy, he won them 6-1 and 6-2. You know, and then you've got to figure the fifth rubber should be pretty close. I mean, this is a pretty good situation for Australia on paper.
Yeah. So do you think it's a bad idea now to back up and talk about how this whole tie was put together from Australia's standpoint?
No, well, I think this is a perfect place to do that.
So to get to that, we should really start with Belgium. Belgium's got David Goffin, who's, obviously he's a top 10 guy. He's been through some injuries and whatnot, but he's been absolutely nails for Davis Cup. Okay, so he's playing both singles matches for sure. He's not a great doubles player. They're not planning to play him in doubles. And then they've got Darcis, who has been, like we said before, stepping up consistently for actually years for Belgium. So they don't have another singles guy to go to that they think is better than Darcis. Okay.
Right.
So they're planning on playing those two guys for all four singles matches.
Right. And they don't have a strong expectation of taking the doubles point.
They don't, because they're playing young guys. Now they're not, they're pretty good. I mean, to be frank. I mean,
sure.
Pretty good. But, you know, John Peers is part of the number one doubles team in the world. He's ranked number two in the individual rankings. He's been very consistent. You know, won a slam this year. He's been marching up. I mean, he's solid. They know what they're going to get from him. And Australia could play really any of their other guys on the team and expect to win that point. But they put Jordan Thompson in, who's a very competent doubles player and steps up well. And they end up winning that point pretty comfortably, like we talked about. So the question I think that most people would start with
is, let me ask the question. Why do you have John Millman in the first round of singles and then you sub him out for Jordan Thompson in the second round of singles?
Right. So, that probably goes back to, why do you have John Millman on the team in the first place? Because initially the team was announced with Thanasi Kokkinakis.
Mm-hmm.
So Kokkinakis, as a lot of people remember, is a big, tall, really singles guy, 6'7", huge serve, huge ground strokes, very aggressive player who's been struggling a lot with injuries for the last 2 years. He's had some good results. He made a final at an ATP, I think, in Mexico. Maybe lost a query. But basically, he's been up and down. He probably wasn't fully good to go. And when Leighton Hewitt and the rest of the staff that makes the Davis Cup decisions, which would be, I might be guessing here, but I know Jason Stoltenberg's involved, and probably Tony Roach. I mean, those guys coached and worked with Hewitt, and they're still very close to Tennis Australia.
Yes.
But when they sit down and they look at the whole tie, right, they care about one thing, which is getting 3 points. I mean, that's the number one priority. Is you show up, and you, right? And then they care about their guys. They want to do right by their guys, and they want to help the guys play better tennis, both during Davis Cup and, you know, throughout the year, because they're thinking, you know, we got a final to play, right? So with Kokkinakis not being really fit and good to go, no reason to put him in. Millman's been playing great tennis. He came back from a surgery last year, and he's just been getting better and better and better. He's also the kind of guy that absolutely wears players out. He will keep you out there for 3 or 4 or 5 hours. He's got the biggest heart on the tour, and he doesn't give you an easy point.
Yeah, we've talked a little bit about Millman previously and how much effort he puts in.
Yeah. He's the same one who got waxed by Rafa in the first round. Sorry, John.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was one of the best matches I think that Rafa's ever played in terms of aggression. That wasn't going to happen in Belgium on red clay. Millman was not going to go down quickly, and there's a darn good chance that Millman was going to win that one. So it looks like what they did was they said, hey, let's play Millman first. Let's see if we can wear down some of the Belgian singles guys, whoever it is. Because they know if they have to go and sub a player and they lose either Goffin or Darcis, they're putting in Ruben Bellemans, who's significantly not as good. Okay.
Right, there's a big step down for them. Once they go past Goffin and Darcis in the depth chart, so to speak.
They think they should get that one. Because that guy...
Yeah, there's lots of quality.
At some point, that guy would have to play Kyrgios, and they think, well, Nick, you have to win that match. And if he doesn't, then too good. Nothing you can do. But they would easily put the expectation there. So playing Millman in early, they think, hey, we got a good shot. Millman can actually win this. I mean, they probably think they're 50-50. Millman probably thinks he's 70-30 to win it. or more. I mean, that guy believes, okay? But they probably think they're 50-50. They end up losing that one in a close, like, 3.5 hour four set. But, hey, they've worn him out some. Then they have a fresh Jordan Thompson for the doubles. A fresh Jordan Thompson with John Peers is a very good doubles team.
Right. They're not good. I mean, you'd struggle to put together a team from anywhere that's going to take those guys down.
No, I mean, they're a top.
Even if you're not just limited to guys who are Belgian.
Right. I mean, I've talked about Thompson beforehand. I think he's one of the underrated up-and-comers on the tour. But he's had some big results. I mean, this is a guy who's out-grinding Ferrer and out-grinding Jack Sock. But he's got a big game. I mean, he goes 130 on the serve. He can volley very competently. He's got some of the best balance and some of the fastest feet you're going to see on the tour. So they get 2-1 up after the doubles. And then they've got basically a fresh but match-tough Jordan Thompson to play instead of Millman, because they rate Thompson as being a little bit better on the top end as Millman because he's got bigger wins.
Sure.
Millman's, you know, kind of a more solid, steady guy. But, I mean, Thompson doesn't miss a lot of balls. And then they figure, hey, we've got Kyrgios as well. So, you know, Kyrgios should beat Goffin, but maybe he loses. Well, Thompson should definitely beat Darcis. I think they felt really good going into that. And if you look at the structure of that team, I mean, frankly, it's really hard to fault Hewitt or anybody else that's involved with Davis Cup in Australia for putting it out that way.
Yeah, no, it seems. I mean, it all makes sense. You know, it all seems like a good strategy.
The surprise was Goffin beats Kyrgios in four, and
yeah,
Larson then.
And doesn't just do that. I mean, Goffin plays a fantastic match to do so.
Yeah,
I mean, Kyrgios shows up, plays hard, plays quite well. I think the best tennis that I've seen Goffin play that I can think of, in all honesty. I mean, he's banging aces on this, like, he's hitting spots on the serve, serving quite a few aces.
He's massive for him. Yeah, he's 5'11".
Yeah, no, he's not traditionally a big server, but he was banging it, and he's not serving aces on a Nick Kyrgios who's just walking side to side looking to get to the changeover.
Mm-hmm.
He's serving aces on, like, an athletic Nick Kyrgios who's actually trying to get them back. And did so consistently throughout the match. I mean, it was a very impressive serving performance from him, first of all.
I mean, for me, I put this as probably Goffin's best match win of his career.
But certainly it's the best match I've ever seen him play.
Yeah, I mean, it's way up there. I mean, there's a spot in the Davis Cup final, which is absolutely huge for Belgium and huge. I mean, it's huge for Goffin. Like, he cares about this in a big way. And if this isn't clear to you, I mean, if you know Kyrgios, maybe you don't know him well enough, he will absolutely lays it on the line for Davis Cup. He does not take Davis Cup lightly.
No.
He does not take representing Australia lightly. I mean, he loves those guys. Those guys on the team between Leighton and Millman and Thompson and Kokkinakis and even, like, the orange boys like Alex Damanar and the up-and-comers, I mean, those are his best friends, literally. He's grown up playing tennis with these guys for years. These are his best friends. This was not, you know, a half-motivated Kyrgios that you may think. This was, he's playing his butt off. And Goffin managed it, handled it, stepped up, and took it home, I mean, almost routinely. Like,
that's... Yeah, I mean, it was hairy. This wasn't, you know, we say almost routinely. I mean, it was a very tight match.
To be able to drop the first set and then win 4-4 and 4, it was super close tennis. It was super high-level tennis. At the end of the day, to be able to get out of that one when it wasn't 10-8 in the fifth, I mean, that's as close to routine, I think, as you're going to get against Nick Kyrgios and Davis Cup on red clay indoors. Like,
I mean, like all the qualifications against Nick Kyrgios in Davis Cup on red clay indoors.
I'm just saying that there was probably 100 different ways that David Goffin could have lost this match, and there was probably only 2 or 3 ways that he could have won it.
Right.
I mean, he stepped up big time.
Yeah, he plays up some lights out. So that brings us to the last rubber, which was Darcis and the aforementioned Jordan Thompson.
Yeah.
And this does not go according to Australia's plan. And okay. Darcis runs away with the match in straight sets. See, this to me is routine. A lot less hairy.
And it was. I mean, Thompson never looked like he was in danger of winning that match. I mean, to me, this comes down to Thompson not going out there with quite the right strategy, with quite the right tactics, playing more not to lose. Where Darcis is going out there playing. And Darcis went out there playing to win. I mean, I don't know what it is that possesses this guy when he plays Davis Cup. It's probably much the same stuff that possesses a lot of the guys. But, you know, when you look at the way that Darcis played this match, when you look at the way that he plays Davis Cup generally, you almost have to look at his singles career and think, you know, this guy should be top 40.
Like, right.
Maybe he's a career underachiever. Because the level of tennis, I mean, Jordan Thompson is he's the real deal, okay? Like, probably he's a little bit tight playing a fifth rubber for Davis Cup. I mean, I can say that with some certainty. He's still going to show up and make a ton of balls. He's going to be the fastest guy out there. He's going to serve well. He's going to make a lot of returns. Like, Jordan Thompson's worst tennis is still not that bad.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of the idea. It's not that bad. So, I mean, for Darcis to get through that so routinely and win three sets that way, you know, Thompson's not a guy who will go away. He's not throwing in the towel. I mean, this is a guy who routinely goes down and wins matches in five sets and routinely does it on the big stage over the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it makes me start looking at Darcis, you know, differently. Like, I was talking to one of the coaches on tour about him because they were worried about playing him near his home, saying that he's like a different animal. And this was a year ago. I mean, this wasn't like a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And so I started really paying attention to it then. And I mean, here he is now. Steve Darcis might end up being the Davis Cup hero in the final.
Right. I mean, and just to put this, he's had a bit of a rocky year. And his career high ranking, by the way, is 38, which he just got in May of this year. And now he's down to 77, I think, in the current rankings. So.
Yeah. So yeah. He was there for weeks.
Yeah, yeah, basically. So, yeah, so I guess the only question really that comes to mind is, given the outcome of that final rubber there, did they make a mistake? Should they have kept John Millman in to play Darcis? Would it have made a difference?
So the one thing, this gets really, really specific in particular to me. If you look at Jordan Thompson and you look at the way he can play, his top end is higher than Millman's right now.
Right.
Okay?
Sure.
I think the way that he can play, it's clear that you play Tama. And Thompson was always going to play. Like, they believe in him. He's earned it. And none of the guys on the team doubt that. None of the guys, I think, at Tennis Australia really doubt that.
Right.
When you look at the matchup, man, you know, the style that Thompson went out there trying to play, which was kind of like red clay, I'm going to grind you down style. Millman's a lot better at that style. Like, that's his breadbasket.
Right.
And I think if they had given Millman a chance, it would have been closer.
But
still don't know if that's the right style to play against Darcis in that fifth rubber. Like,
well, certainly not for Thompson.
Certainly not for Thompson. But Millman's going to play the same sort of style. I think it just would have been better. So I think it would have been closer. I don't know if either one of those guys would have gotten the win. I think, frankly, you need Kyrgios to beat Goffin. That match should be done in the fourth. I mean, Kyrgios is capable of playing monster tennis, and he needed to do it there. And then I think that if Thompson's going to be the guy in that fifth, he needs to go out there. Whoever's going to play Darcis in that fifth needs to go out there and be more aggressive than him. And needs to execute better on that day.
Right, take it out of his hands a little bit. I mean, Darcis is not going to go out there and lay an egg in Davis Cup. Happening.
Let's keep in mind, we've talked about how much Kyrgios cares about Davis Cup. I mean, Darcis went five sets with him in the first rubber. Like,
right.
That had to get your attention. Like, Kyrgios is going out there hitting second serves 130 miles an hour, and Darcis is winning sets. Like, hello, the level here is very high.
Sure.
So I think that was a tough ask. I mean, to me, it's kind of weird. Goffin's kind of the hero, the Davis Cup hero for Belgium right now, because Darcis is actually that consistent. Like, he's actually consistently bringing that level in Davis Cup.
Right, whereas Goffin actually came up with the must win in a sense.
Yeah.
Even though it came,
I mean, he got the must win, even though they were both must wins. So, I mean, that's a little bit surprising. That says a lot about what Steve Darcis is doing. He's kind of the sneaky hero in the background here. But, you know, it's just really, really interesting stuff. I think it's going to be an absolutely fascinating, very high-level tennis tournament match. I don't know what to call the Davis Cup final. I mean, it's obviously a match and it's also a tournament. But France is playing Belgium in the final. That's something I'm going to make time for and try and watch all those matches because, I mean, it's going to be really, really interesting stuff.
So in the other semifinal, France takes down Serbia 3-1 and just not as much drama, not as much tension.
Yeah, I mean, France is loaded. We know that.
Right.
But I don't know. I mean, Dusan Lajovic did beat Lucas Pouillet in the first rubber. Like, that's something.
Yeah, that's a nice win, I think.
It's great. And he took a set off of Sanga.
Yeah.
You know, Pouillet kind of hasn't been playing that great. He's still a top 20 player, so that's...
Right, but yeah, I mean, I remember I was a little disappointed with this US Open, honestly. And then, but Sanga came up big, won both of his singles rubbers, and Hebert and Mahut took care of the doubles pretty handily.
It's going to be interesting to me. I mean, we should note, obviously, if you haven't followed it, Serbia did not have Djokovic. So, I mean, they're playing Dusan Blažević and Laszlo Djere and Filip Krkovic.
Yes, which that's a very, very different kind of setup or look than when Djokovic is in the lineup. I've heard that guy's pretty good at tennis.
Yeah, it's kind of like when Switzerland lost in their early round match because, you know, obviously they didn't have Fed and Stam, so it's a little different when you're...
Yeah, so that puts the final. We've got France against Belgium.
So lots of French speakers there. And
yeah. That'll be an interesting thing because, I think France will take the doubles point. Assuming everybody's healthy and there to play, I mean, I think France would be good for the doubles point in that. It's going to come down to the singles, and that's going to be iffy. I mean, you know, the thing is, I would expect it's going to be played on clay, right?
Well, I don't know who's got the home. I don't know who's got the home.
Well,
they both
picked red clay. So France was the home team for their semi. Belgium was the home team for their semi. They both picked red clay. France went red clay outdoors, whereas Belgium went red clay indoors. If I'm Belgium, I'd probably take it outdoors because I don't want to play Songa indoors on any surface.
And if I've got Goffin and Darcis, I don't know. I might be looking at a hard court, honestly.
Yeah, but, against, for this matchup. I don't know. Yeah, it's a tough one. But either way, yeah, I mean, I got to figure France is going to be good for the doubles point. And then Lovis is going to come down to where Hal Sanga plays. You know, Sanga comes out and plays lights out.
The singles, yeah.
He's very
but
tough.
I don't know if he's going to be on that French team. I don't know if it's going to be Lucas Pouillet. Like, he's not winning. He's not winning off the tour. He's not winning in Davis Cup. I'm not sure that that's what they want to put in there. I mean, Gasquet might get the call up.
This is true.
He plays well in Davis Cup on occasion.
Sometimes. Yeah.
Sometimes not. You know, I mean, that's the trouble with the French team. But I really wouldn't be surprised to see Belgium walk away with this one just based on the massive pressure that's going to be on France. I mean, and, you know, if those guys don't execute, you know, Sanga's plan B is not very good. And Herbert and Mahut and the double.
Does he have a plan B? Is that the thing? I'm being sarcastic. He does. I mean, he does have a plan B, but yeah, I'm with you.
It's really not very good.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, the flip side is we've got 2 months. So in 2 months, who knows what Pouillet might be doing? He might be playing better. But yeah, you know, I'm leaning France on this one. I just feel like with the doubles point in hand, they've got better depth on the singles than Australia did. I just think they're going to pull this one out.
Would it change Would it influence your decision if there were rumors that Mahut and Herbert might be breaking up?
What? Come on, they got to keep the band together at least so they win Davis Cup. are you being serious right now?
I'm just asking if it would change your mind if there were rumors that maybe they weren't getting along so well.
You know, that's interesting. I don't think it really would because the thing about France is they've got other guys who can play good doubles with either of those two guys and still go out there and probably take a point against Belgium. You know, I mean, Songa can play good doubles. I mean, they've got other people that can come in and play good doubles.
Does not play good doubles.
Come on. Well, but I still think, like, if you put him with somebody like Mahut, they're going to be tough. I still think they're going to take care of Belgium at the end of the day. But the problem is I don't know that Songa is going to be good for two singles matches and a doubles match at that point. But regardless, I still think France has taken the doubles point. And so, yeah, I like France's odds on this one.
Just for the record, I think France is going to take the doubles point as well.
Yeah. Well, the question is, do you think France are going to take the whole match?
No, I think they're going to fall in the occasion. I think they're going to do what Kevin Anderson did not do, and I think they're going to be massively affected by the final.
We'll see. Well, but apparently not. Apparently, if somebody just stands somewhere different, they're gonna have a bad serving day. So, and I joke about that. Look, I mean, I do believe that the returner can impact the server. I absolutely believe that. Like, that's, I just don't think that Nadal's positioning is going to. We're still on this. Yes, people, we are still talking about this, or at least I am.
Because I know that you believe that the returner influences.
Right. I just have to make this explicit because, I mean, this is something, you know, a lot of what we try to do is help people. And when we do instructional stuff, I just want to be very clear about this, people. Look, I think changing your court positioning for the returner serve is a great and valid strategy, and I think that you should employ it. I don't think that you should expect somebody to serve 36% first serve when they normally serve in the 60s if you do so.
Well, that's perfectly fair.
So,
I think your analysis of the final, the U.S. Open final, is, in particular in regards to Kevin Anderson, is actually inconsistent with your beliefs when it comes to tennis.
No, but I mean, I, you know, and ironically, I think the same thing for you because you've always placed such a big emphasis on the emotional side of things, and you've talked a lot about, you know, whether people can handle the occasion, and to me, this was just a very, whether or not Anderson puts the first serve in play is the one thing on the court against Nadal that he has complete control over. And he did a terrible job of that. Not even just a bad job. He did a terrible job of that.
One of the things that I think we're going to learn over the next 6 months is if Kevin Anderson continues to march up, both in the rankings and in his results, if he becomes a true top 10 player, then I'm going to look back on this and definitely say, hey, you know, I'm standing by what I said today. Now, if he falters and if he doesn't maintain the level, then honestly, I'll probably look over at it and say, you know, the occasion probably was more of a contributing factor than I thought it was at the time. So I think that we'll actually have an answer to this question, say 6 months or 9 months from now, for sure.
Well, you'll have an answer to this question. I already feel pretty comfortable with mine. You know, but folks, you may agree or disagree. And if you do, either way, we would love to hear from you. So you can reach out to us via email. I am glenn@tacticaltennis.com.
And I'm jacob@tacticaltennis.com.
You can follow us on Twitter. We are @tacticaltennis.
That's pretty easy.
That is pretty easy. And then also, we do have a Facebook page. I will ask you, folks, please do share with your friends. Tweet about the show. We don't advertise in any way, shape, or form. So the only way for us to gain new listeners and followers is with your help.
That's true, and I like to keep it that way.
So, yeah, absolutely, folks. You know, reach out, please do ask questions. If there's something, look, we're heading into the dead period here a little bit. We've got Davis Cup and obviously World Tour finals, but the tennis season is winding down a little bit, and we have done instructional stuff in the past. If there's something specific you would like to hear us talk about, reach out and let us know because we are open to ideas. I mean, you know, we've always got something to talk about. But we are more than happy to talk about some of the stuff that you guys specifically, and girls, want us to talk about. So please do reach out and let us know.
That sounds good. Can't wait to hear it.
Alrighty. Have a good day.
Later.